is Katie Hunter from MMA UK. We're here with another episode of the Fight Chicks podcast. I'm here with my fabulous co-host, Becky Davies.
Hello!
Kerry Stella.
Hello, hello.
And we're joined by a fantastic guest today, Joe Clifford.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, a lot of people are going to know you, recognise you from their TV screens. See you doing like a lot of the UFC cut stuff. But I think what everybody would like to know is how you first got involved in the sport.
Right. I hadn't got a choice in it, to be honest with you. I'll tell you what happened. Dublin in the 80s was a pretty dismal place. It was riddled with heroin. It came in a wave. And my father, well, the neighborhood was a working class to underclass area. And my father seen the need to get me into something that would occupy most of my time, social time. Yeah. And so what he did was he went out the back garden, he took my football boots and he burned them out the back. And he said, you're finished soccer, you're going to boxing. And I was like, I want to play soccer, But anyway, he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and he brought me up to the boxing club, local boxing club, and threw me in the door. And all I remember was that I had a white plastic Dunstores as a chain over here with my underpants and a clean T-shirt because, you know, your tracksuit bottoms, you got to train in them, you sweat a little bit, you can live with that, but your underpants and your T-shirt was your staple diet for clean clothing on the way back home. So I when I went into boxing, it changed. I mean, soccer, you're dependent on 10 people. Gaelic football is our national sport. You're dependent on 14 other people. I walked in the doors of boxing, and although it's team, I just loved the fact that you couldn't blame anybody on a poor performance.
Yeah.
And you had to, it was all or nothing. And I've always been a leader since I was a kid. I captained soccer since I was under six or sevens in goal and stuff like that. And I stopped growing when I was 14, so it was a healthy switch. Being a goalkeeper when you're only 5'7" doesn't work out too well. So it saved my life more ways than one. So that's how I get into it. And it was through boxing that I was introduced to cutman stuff.
So what was it, your dad's reason for wanting to get you away from soccer?
Heroin. It was all over the place.
Wow.
And, you know, and there's something like, when I think I owe him so much, he's still alive. And the greatest gift a father can give to his son is to steer him in the right direction, give a child direction. He did that in his own way. And then I'm employed in the same sport that he introduced me to. So, I mean, as a father, it doesn't get better than that. And the thing was, most of my friends are dead. I only have a handful of friends left because that whole generation were just wiped out. Wiped out.
I know America
and the UK.
No heroin in the boxing gyms.
Sorry?
There was no heroin in the boxing gyms then at all.
See, the thing is, it would have been on the outdoor. It would have been outside. On the immediate outside. And there would have been people that would have came in, like children that were affected by it. I can't remember a family that wasn't touched by HIV AIDS at that point, or ODs or violent deaths. I can't remember. And I remember a kid, I'm not going to say his name, that used to come into the gym, and his mother and father were both HIV positive. And at the time, that wasn't a cure. And so he used to come in, and we were his family for a period of time, and then we lost him around about 14 or 15 when he grew up, a little bit older. He was only 8 or 9 at the time. And he was so talented. But, you know, he'd come into the boxing club and he would, he would look around before he boxed to see if his mother or father were there. And if they weren't, he'd be really upset. And so, to some degree, we filled in that gap. Like, you know, boxing clubs have been around for 150 odd years or something like that, you know, like historically. But we provided a service in communities for far long, well, since we first opened the doors. And the thing is, there's always been in underclass areas and working class areas and stuff like that, you know. And it's, you know, they're in places that it's needed. You know, people go on about traumatic brain injury, not go on. I totally rephrase that. People have now are more aware, and myself, of traumatic brain injury. But if I weigh that up in comparison to what the kids get back from it, they, you know, like in terms of not only being extremely healthy, but getting to travel and having excitement and adventure, and if they're good enough to represent their region or their country and stuff like that, you know what I mean? So it's much more than just a club, because it's so intense at times. You get inspired and you could, you know, you could have really tough sessions, and then you see the same person in, you know, in the back room, in the shower room when you're getting dressed, and there's no animosity, there's nothing. All the fight's gone out of you. I don't want to go on the street and fight after that, you know. Yeah. So it definitely gave me something soccer could have never given me, or Gaelic and stuff. You can still be a pisshead in the weekends and soccer. Boxing, it just didn't permit you to do that, you know what I mean? 14 yeah. years of age, I was training twice a day, you know, so.
And you a lot of HIV around. Were you nervous of training with people who have HIV, of there being blood around? And
everybody was paranoid. I mean, if you really think about that period of time, if you knew somebody was HIV positive, you're almost afraid to drink out of the same glass as them. Yeah. Because there was no education or no information, and it was shocking, really. And so until that information became, you know, publicly known, and it came down to all of us, like, well, then it kind of changed. In terms of boxing and blood spatter and stuff like that, I suppose you never think the kid that's in front of you or you're training with is HIV positive. Or you just didn't, you know. It just never crossed your mind. It just never crossed your mind, you know. But it's possible. It was possible, yeah.
God, that was a heavy start to the podcast, everyone. That was
Well, you are.
Yeah, but it makes sense. It is that's a very good question, because at the moment, obviously, Gareth Thomas, the rugby player, the information he's given out now to everybody. So that ties in with everything that Gareth Thomas is doing now to inform people about HIV. Now in this day and age, as opposed to HIV in the day and age you were talking about, Joe, in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. There was no turning back then. Yeah, I mean, it was a death sentence then, but things have changed, I know. But that was the reasons I get in. And once I was in, it was like a protective shell in more ways than one. Because in my neighborhood, you had to fight. It was territorial. You had to fight. It was just territorial. And if you boxed, like, they'd see you running in the mornings. And in a way, it was like a protective shell. Like, they'd see it, and they know you were a member of a boxing club. So, a little bit apprehensive about jumping on you and stuff. So, you know, it served me in more ways than I can ever repay it. It's still my passion, my love. You know, like, I just can't speak enough about the benefits I got out of it as a man. Not only as a child, but as a man, it's installed certain characteristics in me today. A drive, a motivation, that toughness, resilience, you know, like, just to keep going forward, regardless of what happens. Just pick yourself up and get on with it, you know what I mean, kind of thing. Yes. I don't regret it for a second. It's been a great journey for me, boxing. But that's how I get into it.
Those are the benefits that I always tell everybody about any martial art. I just think that, you know, all of those things are so good for the kids today. And yes. So how did you move on to the Cutman side of things? Was that when you were in the gym? And
what actually happened was I've been in the gym, God, since I was a nipper. And at one point then, I think I was 23. No, it wasn't. It was actually, I'd stopped boxing for a period of time. And when I came back, I was a little bit older. I was 27, then boxed for a period and then stopped. I think it was around about 32. I'd come back into the gym. I'd been away for a little bit, come back into the gym. Because it never leaves you. you know, the thing about boxing or mixed martial arts, you'll always throw shapes in the mirror. You know, you get in the mirror and you shadow box that. You hear Rocky in the background and you're throwing jabs and backhands and stuff like that. So, but it never left me. And I wanted to get involved again. So I went back down to the boxing club because, like, there's a gape and a hole that's left when you quit.
Yeah.
And the transition then into doing something else, because I'm stopped training twice a day. I'm not training anymore. What do I do next? Like, it's such a huge void to fill. And so I went back to the club and they said, right, you want to get into coaching? Yeah, you can start with the kids. So I started with the kids. And then eventually what happened, the same club turned professional. Crumlin Boxing Club turned into Dolphin Promotions, and then we had Nine Pros, and they said, look, I was studying doing a degree, a bachelor's degree in applied health science and physical therapy, and they asked me, they thought I was all first aidy and asked me would I, you know, do the cuts in the corner. So that's how I ended up doing it. Phil Sutcliffe.
And what about the MMA side of things? When was the first time you heard about MMA, and when did you first get involved in that whole scene?
MMA happened. I was in Sweden. I ended up in Sweden, and I was working with the Northern Swedish boxing team called IFK Umeå. Now the standard of boxing over there is getting better, but doesn't. It's not the same as Great Britain or the British Isles. It's just not the same. They're not a kind of a boxing. They are a boxing nation, but they just don't have the structures in place to be successful at it. But I've been around it my whole life, and I've been blessed to be trained by Olympians and various other. Phil Sutton was a two-time Olympian, and then later on by Paddy Hyland. And so when I went there, I was quite experienced, and I ended up working in the gym. And then I did a little stint, very small stint. I worked with the Northern Swedish boxing team. So basically what happens is it's like a funky thing. They split the country in two because it's so long, and they have the north and the south kind of regions. And I ended up working with Northern Swedish boxing team. I actually carried that flag, their colours. The ugliest Swede in the group, I have to say, in comparison to some of them. And then I met a boy called Andreas Michael. And Andreas was manager of the Swedish boxing team. I had a good connection with Andreas. I came back home. He gave me a call out of the blue, and he asked me, would I take on sparring for a heavyweight, a light heavyweight? And I said, yeah, of course. And so he then rang me back and he said, look, can you get rolling? And I didn't know what rolling was. I just thought, well, you know, what's that about like? And he's saying, well, it's you know, it's wrestling. It's like wrestling and stuff. So I only knew of two gyms, and I ended up calling Andy Ryan and Team Rhino. And I said, look, there's a fella looking for some rolling when he comes over. And Andy says, well, who is it? This is 2009, 2010.
Yeah.
And he said, who is it? I said, I don't know. I said, I'll ring up. So as it turns out, it was Alex Gustafsson.
So, oh, my God.
I called Alex. Andreas is a good pal of mine. He's been a good pal of mine because I obviously know him that long. I called back up and I said to Andy, I said, there's a fellow by the name of Alex Gustafsson. I think I'm more to the surname. I called him Goosey something or something or other. Andy says, are you sure about that? And I said, yeah, I'm 100% sure that's what he said his name was, because I think he was six fights into the UFC. And at the time, that was huge, huge, you know. So because the UFC, like 10 years ago, was a whole different place. And anyway, Alex ended up staying in my house for 10 days.
No way.
Yeah, I actually have a picture of it on Facebook somewhere. So, yeah, that's great. So that's how I crossed over into MMA. I was working at the boxing cup, man, and then I went into MMA. So then I done cold sales. Kerry just disappeared.
Nope, I'm back. Sorry about that.
All right. If you need a moment to yourself, it's okay.
Nope, I don't know what happened. I'm like, whoa. So, Joe, were you doing Cupman stuff for Alex when he was over, or that was when you first got involved on the scene? And then what was your first MMA bout that you were actually a cut person for?
I was quite successful in boxing, right? So Alex came over at that time. And Andreas said to me, Andreas Michael, and I always give him a ton of credit for this. He said, you need to jump. I said, what do you mean? He said, you need to jump. Boxing's dying. You need to get away from boxing as fast as possible. MMA is the thing. I'm telling you, you need to jump. So I said to Andy Ryan, Team Rhino, I said, look, Alex went home. I said, I'm looking for a bit of graft. I said, he said, well, you can come up and, you know, if you want to turn up at the events, like Cage Contender was the event up north. And at the time, Neil Seary, who later went on to work with the UFC, and Paul Redmond and John Redmond, and there was a few of them there that were fighting. They were the fight team. Two of them became UFC fighters. Neil Seary, well, he's like a junkyard dog. He done really well for himself out of it.
Yeah.
And I just offered my services for free. Now, you got to remember, like, for anybody listening in, everybody wants shortcuts. Nobody wants to be groomed for success anymore. People don't want the hard work. They just want to cut straight to the chase. They want to kind of go to the next place before they've earned it. And I didn't really need to go into MMA and start from scratch doing cold sales, knocking on doors, say, look, I'll work for free. Just open the door for me. Because boxing was far more lucrative at the time, and you were getting paid far more money. Like, for a pair of hands, you know, you could get paid £50 for wrapping a pair of hands at the time. Really? For a world title contention fight, you could get $1,000. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then you come back, and you go into MMA, and you know, like, you're traveling for the hell of it. But I did it because I needed the experience of MMA to actually become good at it. So I done all the cold sales and ended up in some shitholes over the years and some really dodgy spots and all the rest of it. But yeah, that's how I crossed over.
Wow. But Becky, tell us how you came to meet Joe.
I was working as a commissioner on Bama, and I'd always watched what the cut men did there, and I was always in awe of what they did, especially the hand wrapping. Thought it was an art form, and I thought, oh, I must find out more about this. So I was directed to Bob Plant, who was working as a cut man on Bama. Bob again. So I asked Bob what I should do, and he said, well, there's Joseph Clifford is running some courses. So I was like, oh, I must get into this, because it's really what I want to do. So I contacted Joe, and then I went on this course in Manchester. I think it was in Manchester. I'm pretty sure it was in Manchester.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
It was Manchester, yeah. And I just thought this man has got so much knowledge about everything. I thought, I'm going to make this man's going to be my mentor. You know, he's the man to be my mentor. And on this course was Jamie Sheldon was the guest on the course, and he did a hand wrapping clinic on the course, and which I videoed, and I just thought it was amazing. Jamie's hand wrapping was absolutely amazing, out of this world. So I thought, I really must learn this craft. So after I went on Joe's course, I then went on, I went to Bulgaria with Joe as part of his cuts team after the course, just to, you know, to go through the whole process of the exam and everything. And unfortunately, at the time, I'd started taking my medication for my back problem, and it was quite severe medication, which I'm still on, but at the time it was new to me. So I would get up in the morning, get stuck in with the fighters. Joe knew about the medication. Joe knew about my back problem. He was totally supportive of the whole thing, which, you know, I always... Sorry, what was that?
I have moments. Yeah.
You have your moments, yeah. You have your moments. You've got to catch him in the right moment. But yeah, he was great. And so it was with guidance that I sort of, the tablets knocked me out a little bit in the night time. But in the morning, I was fine to get stuck in each morning. It was a fantastic experience under Joseph Clifford. And I wouldn't want to do anything like that without Joe. You know, I'd rather have the guidance of Joe in any kind of experience like that, in on a big event like that. I would rather Joe be the boss type of thing. So and that's how I learned my skill and my craft rather. And I just did exactly what Joe told me to do. And I went off and I did shows for free, like Joe said, and that's how I got started. So Joe is always there for all the people that go on Joe's course. Joe is always there in the background if anybody needs any help or if anybody wants to ask questions. Mm-hmm. He's always there in the background. So he's a proper mentor for all of us, actually. So yeah, so that's the only nice thing I'll say about Joe.
Give me a second to let that register.
Nice. I'm not saying anything else.
And Becky, for anyone who doesn't know, tell everyone about the Lioness Cut Team now and what you do with your girls.
Oh right, well Joe was totally supportive of everything that we've done. It's just three of us girls, CJ, Nicola and myself. We all went on Joe's course, and since we were in the UK, we all decided to form a team. Obviously, the girls are in the UK and I'm in Wales, so we just sort of work things out between ourselves, what shows we do and everything. So we're like a full team, you know, three of us. But Joe has always been supportive of us. Whatever we do, wherever we go, if we've got any questions, you know, he's a mentor for the three of us. Oh, so, nice. Yeah, we just formed that team out of Joe's course, really.
But the, you know, the thing is 17% of all participants, like I say, we've trained nearly 2,000 people, 1,547. Now, that's, if realistically, we've done 457 this year alone. Right. Out of those, like the figures over the last couple of years, 17% of all of them have been female. And we need more. The reason why I'd always encourage females, and the reason I have a soft spot I remember when Katie Taylor was actually training and she'd won 3 world titles. She was still boxing in stadiums that were empty.
Yeah.
And she'd achieved something that no other athlete in this country had ever achieved. And yet, there were, like, we have inter-county football teams. When it came to Sports Person of the Year, because of population votes and friends, contacting friends to vote for certain people, she never got a look in. And it bothered me. And when I went to Sweden, it flips over because Sweden have such a high ratio of female fighters. You've got Anna Ingman, world champions, I should say. Anna Ingman, Frida Wahlberg, tragically got that traumatic brain injury. Frida Wahlberg, I'm trying to think of the other girl's name. But there's 3 of them that stick out. And then Helena Falk as an amateur and stuff. So, like, socially, very, very different countries in the way the sport is represented. And female soccer get as many people turning up to watch female soccer in Sweden as, well, nearly as much, and I hope somebody corrects me, as males do. So they've worked really hard on social or gender divides, really just closing those gaps. And, you know, and then you come home again and, like, you got the females boxing team who may do well and medal, but yet they get very, very little support, you know. So I don't like that. I've always been on the side of the underdog, when you live in an underclass area, you know what an underdog is. You know what an underdog is, you know, and it just bothered me. And so I've always encouraged females to come into it, because basically we need a balance. We need a balance between the two. Like the days of male-orientated sports are over. There may be a larger population of males involved in sport, but there are no places that females can't really go anymore in sport, or like maybe golf clubs on a Sunday or a Saturday are still those places. I don't know. I've always wanted more women to get involved and come into it, you know. I'm really, to be honest with you, like, if you look at the UFC, what the UFC have done very well is, like, you got Amanda Nunes and you've got so many good female fighters, and I've lived through the year. I was actually at Holly Holm. I was walking Holly Holm versus Ronda Rousey. I was in Australia for that one. And it's incredible how far or how much that sport has honored women in comparison to boxing, who've let women down tragically. Like, when I'll go back into the 80s again and the 90s, and I can think of Christy Martin versus Deirdre Gogarty. And that was on the undercard from Mike Tyson. And those two girls just went at it. And they were entering that ring, not many people expected a lot. But after six rounds, I think it was six or eight rounds of boxing, the hairs were standing up in your neck, just watching the two of them go at it. And it gave women's boxing far more respect than it ever had before, far more weight. Christy Martin was like the Mike Tyson of females boxing at the time. And if you think of where females boxing is today, where you have a world champion, a female who's a world champion, and she's boxing before the doors open, and she sold, you know, like thousands of dollars worth of tickets. How disrespectful is that? And how badly represented females are in the world of boxing. You compete, Kerry, right? You still compete. You still fight? Yeah.
Oh, no. Unfortunately, it's really funny. I was just actually telling my dad the other day. They went the wrong route with me. I was a very troubled young person, and my dad had the misconstrued viewpoint that if he put me in any kind of martial arts, which really kind of stupid considering he taught me how to box, him and my grandfather, but he had this opinion that if he put me into fighting that I was going to continue to fight and be worse than I was, which it probably would have humbled me and put me in a different direction. I know it would have, where I would have been way more disciplined, and I would have been, you know, that anger would have been gone, and it wasn't, and it stuck with me for a long time. Plus, I was an addict, so by the time I finally got really great at kickboxing and I was like ready to go, I took a couple injuries that just were never, they were life-changing. So unfortunately I didn't get to, but on the bright side, I do kickbox just to stay in shape. There's no reason not to. It's actually one of the best workouts you can do for yourself aesthetically, you know, for your cardio. For, I could go on and on why not even just to lose weight. Martial arts is just one of the best things anybody can do. I could give a million and ten reasons why you should, and why people should put their kids into it. You know, I tell people, you got a kid that's having behavioral issues, don't do it. My dad did. Go put him in martial arts. Have him get their ass kicked by someone smaller than them. They might not be so quick to you know, throw their hands up or to talk back. This is what it is, you know?
Yeah.
But I do see the directness of how women aren't treated fairly in boxing and in MMA. I mean, we get paid considerably less. You see Heather Hardy, that gets paid like next to nothing for both her, you know, for her boxing. She'll talk about it all the time. And to me, personal opinion, I don't think that the money that they make for MMA is nearly enough either, especially not in America. Because from what I've heard overseas, like in Ryzen, they make a ton of money over there. I've heard it's completely different.
But the UFC, I know the top girls in the UFC get paid well.
Well, the top girls, but the ones that aren't. And I mean, guys either too, but the pay scale to me is different. The women still don't make as much as the guys. And sometimes their fights are, you know, sometimes they're more exciting. It's crazy.
The UFC have actually rewritten the script, and I know I know basically they promote women far better than any boxing organization ever have. And they've done a lot of work in terms of promoting women in the sport themselves. And I suppose, I've always loved Misha Tate. She's a complete lady. I've just the way she carries herself, the way she conducts herself.
She's amazing.
And yeah, she turns around when she's in there. But the I suppose the whole point, the conversation is like, we just, it's a shame that, I suppose, again, it's probably the argument of nurture and nature and all that, and women gravitate towards people and caring rather than to get involved in martial arts and various other and all the rest of it. So, and a lot of people do it out of knee-jerk reactions to be violently attacked or something like that, or the fear of being violently attacked and stuff. But I suppose it is, I agree with you, it's so character building. And the impact that has on people's lives is, regardless of what standards you, I was crap. I'm not being humble. It's just, I'm being honest. I was crap as a boxer, but I just, you know what? If they give out medals for actually training, I probably would have got something out of it. You know what I mean? But unfortunately, they don't. But no, it's given me a lot. But look, I mean, the changes in the sport today, like the whole Cutman stuff is when I initially came into it, it was very male orientated. When I looked for information, I couldn't get it off anybody. And I'm not a sheep. I don't follow. I never have. I suppose I did when I was younger. I take that back. When you're going through those years and you're searching, when you're a teenager or adolescent and you want to know who you are, where you're going, what you stand for, what you sit for, you know, I suppose as I got older and a little bit maturer, I just seen the futility in following people. I don't like following people. I've seen, especially in my neighborhood, you know, if you follow certain people, you ended up in bad places. And so I learned from, I suppose, when I started to become more aware of the results of hanging with certain groups and stuff like that, that was it for me. I stopped following. I was very independent in what I wanted to do. Boxing kept me that because I was training by myself. I was on my own. I was running in the mornings. I wasn't taking drugs. I wasn't drinking alcohol. I wasn't doing any of that. I was totally boxed off from the social scene as a teenager. And it saved me bacon in more ways than one. But the thing is, when I come into the cutman profession, when I asked for information, nobody gave it. They all protected it. And it was all smoke screens and all this stuff. And I was really, I wanted to know. I wanted to be good at it because I'm highly competitive. I've never not been competitive. Both my father and my uncle are professional football players. So sport swims my veins and my blood. And when I used YouTube as a reference. And when I started looking at YouTube, at the time I was studying, I was doing a bachelor's degree and I was actually in your cat's going to kill itself.
Kimmy. Mine?
Your cat's going to kill
itself. I don't think you understand. This cat is insane. She's like jumping. I'm like, what is going on? I'm trying so hard to keep her out of this. I keep jumping on the mat. But I see her little ears poking up on my cat. You're not seeing this cat.
It's all
Kerry's. Kerry's cats are the star of the show.
For anyone listening, my cats are usually the cats. Catching the podcast. It's just that they always do. They're party prancers.
Or else they just take off. They just go in these sprints. They just take off in a sprint for no reason.
And the they're best is when they do their cat jitsu and they start rolling around together. I love it. I'm like, this is great.
Animals. And they definitely have their own methods, but
they do. Going back to your course, obviously Becky's done it. Like you were saying, that you found it really hard to get information. Now I'm glad that there's someone out there, you know, at a very high level who can teach these courses. You know, people who walk away with that qualification, it actually means something to people.
I'm glad.
I didn't. I did it myself as well, just because I'm obsessed with MMA and I just want to get all the information that I can. So even if you don't end up as a cut person or don't intend to, I just think it's invaluable, the things you learn on this course. I think you've got a few coming up next year. I wondered if you could tell us where they are, if you can remember.
Dublin, the 26th of January, Dublin, Ireland, and then the 2nd of February, Birmingham. So Birmingham on the 2nd of February of 2020. And then Boston. It looks like Boston. I'll be out in Boston again April and May.
Okay. You know, where do people find out about that?
They can go on to Facebook, Minute Medicine Man, or Joseph Clifford, and same on Instagram, Minute Medicine Man, LinkedIn, Minute Medicine Man, Instagram, I said that. When you get older, you repeat yourself a lot. You can't remember the first thing you said when you're only on the fourth thing, and it's a conversation you're having over a 2-minute period, and like you're like, oh, what did I just say? Yeah. Brain turns to mush. But no, information was hard, like to put together, and to be honest, it pissed me off more than anything else that people wouldn't share, because if you don't share, sharing is caring. End off. Yeah. Sharing is caring. If you keep it to yourself, it's never going to grow. And it really bothered me that you know, I had to look for references elsewhere. And when I did, and because I'd come from, you know, like institutions, I'd been working in hospitals and institutions at the time, to see what people were doing at the side of a ring, had no logic, had no education, there was no standard of care whatsoever. And then I looked at the world's best, or what was the world's best, and I just thought to myself, you know, it's a facade. It's not what it's supposed to be, and people are using these people as references. So look, my shit stinks. I make mistakes, and I use my own material when I run the course these days, and I say, look, what do you see? And if, you know, on the groups that we run, when people participate, I post my own stuff up and I ask people to analyze it. And my peers range from 23 years of age to 60 years of age. I've no problem putting my work up there for other people to have a look and say, yeah, you know what, that was good, but you could tweak that. Because the only way, because I've worked in high performance models in boxing, and the only way you get better is if you sit down and analyze things and you get rid of the prima donna, and you forget your ego is not your amigo, and you box it off to one side, and you just become humble. Then you have a chance of becoming really good at your game, because basically you're just open to other people's interpretation of what you're doing, and you'll probably be presented with stuff you never seen yourself. And so the benefits of even people who think they know nothing and they state the obvious, even in fights, they say, you know what? They watch boxing and they'll say things like, you know, I seen such and such fight the weekend and I honestly thought that the other fella won. And they're 100% correct. Yeah, they actually did win. They just, the right person didn't win it, because there's motives and agenda behind winning sometimes. And it's the same with the cutman profession. The reason why there was motives and agenda with it was because they don't want the competition. They don't want to be surrounded by competition. But competition is healthy. Competition is healthy. If you've got competition, well, now you got your standard of care, it's got to shine. Or otherwise, you're just left in the shadows all the time. But the problem is, we've created a whole generation of social media maniacs. Now, I have to admit, I use social media to sell my courses. I hate doing it. I absolutely hate doing it. I just find it an invasion of my privacy. I just hate doing it. And I hate all this happy shit that people post. I don't mean I hate happy shit. I love happy shit, but it's not an honest representation of who you are. And if I come across as a person that you wouldn't be able to swipe a credit card between the cheeks of my arse, you're probably right on occasion, you know, like, because in order for me to make something happen, I had to be a hammer. I had to say, like, this is wrong, it's wrong. It, you know, like the whole situation out there, people are using dangerous drugs, they're administering it to third parties. You can't do that. It's against Great Britain laws, it's against American laws, even in Massachusetts, in the state. I was in Massachusetts, I went to Nevada and various other, I done the East and West tour last year. the law categorically states you can't use it unless you're medically qualified to do so, or else you hold certificates to say that you can use the drug. And the thing is, we've been using it for so long, we've just failed to look elsewhere, and there's an arrogance and an ignorance with it, and there's and they're just protecting it. And it's like it's an era or a generation that's just going to go away. There's a whole generation coming through. But unfortunately, if we don't share, if we don't share the good stuff, well, then what they do is they replicate the last stuff, and it just becomes a repetitive cycle. So I wouldn't be the most light cut man out there in lots of regards, in regards to some of the older school heads. They see me as a threat or whatever, I don't know, but I love them all, because we all have a place here. You know, when you look at Joe Sosa, if you look at his work, and I have used sometimes examples like Vitali Klitschko versus Lennox Lewis, when he treated the laceration on Klitschko's eye. I mean, it's not his best work ever. But you know what? He brought the profession forward. He was the one that was mixing plants, aloe vera with sealants, the likes of grease, petroleum jellies and butter milk and stuff like that, way before it ever became mainstream. So in his own way, he's a Hall of Famer. He brought the profession forward, and he started looking at other products to use, you know, because it's constantly evolving and changing. So it's never going to stay the same. So if you dig your heels in and say, this is the only way we can do business, well, then you're not going to survive too long. I'm not saying my way is the only way. I'm not saying at all, but I just need to, I love the profession so much. I just can't see a future in using adrenaline when we're not legally allowed to use it. Like, a commission can't supersede your country's medicine laws and tell you can go use a bottle of adrenaline. They're breaking the law. It's as simple as that. And they can pretend they're not and say that the doctors are standing behind them supervising the whole thing, but that's a lie. I know.
Because I thought you had to be licensed over here to use adrenaline, but I was informed whilst at an event watching somebody use adrenaline, I was informed that no, you didn't have to be licensed. Anyone can use adrenaline.
So your license is only to accept you in the door and for insurance purposes as a member of the British Board of Boxer Control, right?
Yeah.
That's all the license is for. The license doesn't now qualify you to use a drug that can potentially give you cardiac arrest. That's a paramedic who's done years of training, who's certified to use the drug in case of cardiac arrest or anaphylactic shock and various other. That license is just to accept you in the door, to make it an acceptable norm that you've come through a standard. And that standard now allows you to walk in professional boxing. There is no way that license categorically states that you can use adrenaline 1:1,000 or any other prescribed drug unless you're medically qualified to do so.
So basically,
anyone
can.
Everybody's been doing it for decades. They've been doing it for decades.
And how do they administer it?
Swabs.
Right. Okay.
Swabs. And so the thing is, like, you can't dose measure anything when you put it on a swab.
Yeah.
But again, like, I have to keep on saying this. I love the profession so much. I love it so much. I just wanted to bring it to a place where there was a future for it. And guess what? We work with the emergency services over here in Ireland. I know every doctor, every paramedic, and even on the international scene, the first thing I always do on an event is go over and shake hands with them. Hey, you doing? My name is Joe. This is what I do. I use natural products. I don't use team. We're working together as a team. I only treat superficial injuries. I don't actually. Another thing that we do in corners is that when we treat, we release the patient to go back and box again. That's breaking the law. You don't have the medical qualification to tell a fighter that he can go and fight. The doctor is the only person that can do that. So realistically, the doctor should be over your shoulder all the time, monitoring the injury. And the doctor's the person that tells the fighter whether he can fight or not. But that's not the way professional sport works, or amateur. Why? It's dollar value. The last thing they need is quick stoppages on fights.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just the way the world rolls around.
So Joe, tell me, what's the minimum requirement for a cut person to get a license at an event? Do they need like a minimum first aid standard? Not everyone's been on your course who's a cut person, presumably. Right.
In the British Board of Boxing Control, basically, they have their own first aid course. But it's not very specific to cut man. It's not very specific. They may or may not. I'm giving you secondhand news, and I don't want to say something that's not true. But as far as they have a first aid course, but that first aid course doesn't qualify you to use adrenaline 1:1000. That's a very, very specific course, and you'd have to go through the route of first responder, EMT, or paramedic to actually qualify to specialise to use the drug.
Yeah.
So let's be clear on that. And MMA or boxing, really all you have to do to use the drug is put on a T-shirt with Cutman on the back of it. That's the only qualification.
And what about just to turn up at an event and be a Cutman?
Yeah, get a T-shirt. Course,
if I wanted to turn up this weekend at my local show and offer my services, what do I need to do to be a cut person there? What do I need to show them? What documentation or?
None. Nothing.
Okay.
Zip, zero, zilch. And that's all.
So it's up to the promotion to hire someone that they
Yeah, the promotions do. But the thing is, the promotions like the word cheap.
It's cheap.
And some promotions who don't like the word, some promotions who invest in having a cut team there. There are some good individuals there. There are some great cut men that use and cut women that use adrenaline 1:1000. Like, they're very good at what they do. But they equally have the same knowledge, or I hope they have, that I have. And if they don't, they should really have a look into it.
Yeah.
Because it's not the way forward. It's just not. We can't coexist with healthcare practice the way we're doing business. We just can't. And again, because I love this the profession so much, it's the reason why, and I have a constitution as a therapist where I can't administer a dangerous drug or any kind of prescription drug to a third party. I can't. On my constitution, I break it. And then I could be struck off the register. We have a regulatory board over here. I'd be struck off the register. But other people don't bear those consequences because they're not a registered healthcare practitioner or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It's still illegal. It doesn't change anything. We have a responsibility. I've been unlucky to be around death in the sport. And what pisses me off the most in the sport is that we live off a cliche called one more round. Give a fighter one more round. You know what? Just maybe the fighter doesn't need one more round. Just maybe they don't need one more round. Maybe they need to call it a day right here, right now. And maybe they need somebody in their corner with a set of balls on them or other organ.
Mm-hmm.
Say enough's enough. Enough's enough. It's over. It's done. It's done. You know, having a little bit of compassion. See, when the stakes are high, there's a huge part of the course that's all about clinical decision making. Critical decision making at key moments in fights, and we use videos of catastrophes and deaths that have happened in sport because of lackluster standards, and because promoters didn't want to invest in ambulances or a proper ambulance crew, and put volunteers in place or their mates with a first aid kit. Or they didn't recognize the signs and symptoms of traumatic brain injury.
Yeah.
And the whole deal with the course is not about how to wrap hands and how to treat faces and hygiene and sanitation. It's about being very aware of the signs and symptoms of traumatic brain injury. Because usually we're forced contact when we go out there. And we're so desensitized by concussion because we see it all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay. I box myself, and when you used to get concussed, you say, right, just give me a round, I get my head together and jump back in again. Because you knew nothing about concussion. And what I know about concussion now today, I'd probably be very reluctant to let my child box.
Yeah.
What I know about it now today, it just blows my mind. In terms of, we at presently in Ireland have 1 in 5 professional boxers. I'm going to remove, sorry, that's incorrect. we've won in five individuals who've competed in combat sports now attending neurological hospital, Beaumont. One in five. It's the elephant in the room. It's the elephant in the room. And it's not only football, and I'm not jumping on the bandwagon. I've been around long before concussion ever hit mainstream. And I'm just more sensitive to it because the older I've got, the less I can stomach seeing fighters taking a beating. Even heavy sparring sessions when fighters are taking big shots to the head. It's unnecessary.
Yeah.
You know, it's just unnecessary. And we need to be more sensitive about that. And that's what the course is about. Because I care about you. I care about males and females that are sitting still. I don't give a flying fuck about your ego. I really don't.
Yeah.
I don't care where you've been and who you've walked with and what show you've been on or whether you're whatever. You know, I don't care which, whether you're from Nevada, you fell out of Don King's arse. I couldn't give two shits. I couldn't. All I care about is that you take care of the individual sitting on the still.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
you give them a gold standard of care rather than some bullshit you've made up in your own gym. And you're opinionated about without any evidence to it whatsoever, whether it works or not. That's all I care about. And that's all I've ever cared about. And once you got that in your head, you never go wrong. You know, yeah. So
you were talking about critiquing your own work, but I just wondered if we could bring up a few like recent events that you could give us your opinion on. It sounds like you don't mind critiquing others, but stop me if you'd rather not comment. One that just massively stood out to me at the time as someone who's only done your course once and had no more experience on it, the cut that Tyson Fury had in his last fight just looked like the cut man dumped an entire tub of Vaseline on an open wound and hoped for the best.
Mm-hmm.
That's an obvious opinion. What did you make of it?
There's a word going around that people say integrity, and integrity is like has become now shutting up when you should say something. That's the new meaning for integrity today. I have to say, as a cut man, that, you know, I heard after the fight he got a bonus for the actual fight itself. You know, as a cut man, there were a number of things that stood out in my mind. The end game for us is to stop bleeding, right? That's what they say. That's what we're there in the corner to earn our crust is to stop bleeding. But there were a couple of things that stood out in my mind that were anything that weren't so good. There were times you use so much. Compression is a good thing, but too much where somebody winces is not a good thing. And then when you get in, if you see an injury and it's not a, you know, it's mm-hmm. severe, it is a severe injury. The last thing you do is verbalize it when you see it. Oh, man, you got two cuts, man. You got two. And you can see Tyson Fury's face. Again, that's something that's not quite professional. That's actually very unprofessional to say that out loud. Then he also started coaching Tyson Fury. As a paid cut man coming in as an independent, you never do that, right? You just never do that. Like, the amount of grease he put on his eye went into Tyson Fury's eye, not only once between rounds, but I think two or three times. Correct me if I'm wrong. So as a professional, me watching that, if that's what people think is a good job, right? If that's what people think is a good job, it just highlights the education in terms of people's education about what the profession is. It just highlights what people really know about the profession, honestly. It really does. And it hurts me because it hurts us all. Yeah. You know what I mean? And the thing is, he'll get lots of gigs and lots of work out of that. He'll get tons of work out of it. Tons of it. You know, he'll be the new kid in the block and people will treat him like a diva. And I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's people will use that as an example of how to stop bleeding. And that's unfortunate because, no.
Yeah. Well, the opposite side of that to me was a cut that it was obviously a very bad cut. But a fight, and I was actually there, so I couldn't see up close the way everyone good on telly, but the Nate Diaz cut, to me, it looked like they stopped the bleeding. And although it was a bad cut, I was quite surprised that they ended it at the end of round three, because it looked like the bleeding had stopped to me.
I to be honest with you, I seen that injury and I thought it was the right decision.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was the right decision. I thought not only was it the right decision, I'm blessed that I work with the Premiership of officials.
Yeah.
On the UFC, they're the Premiership by far. You go and work with the UFC, your game doesn't go up one notch, it goes up so many notches. Because basically you're surrounded by the world's best in every form of fashion. And Scott Wren, Rob Monroe, Rudy Hernandez, this Ted Garcia, Bob Plant. You know, like, you're just surrounded. I know the female, the girl that's in there, Swayze Valentine. You know, like, there's so much talent in there that your own game goes up tenfold. And I think they made the right decision, because I seen that the day after. I'd seen pictures of that the day after when he actually got sutures on it. Wow, that was a whopper.
After I saw the cut, I was like, that is a terrible, whopper. Terrible cut. But at the time, I was like, it's not bleeding. I feel like
that's a good cut. Yeah.
There was a fight the following weekend, and I can't remember who it was, UFC in Brazil, whose eyebrow was practically hanging off, and they let it go. So it's, to me, where is the commissions that are being held accountable? You know what I mean? Like, it should be like a clearer across, like, the rules need to be unified in general. Like, they're not, and that's a clear, direct message of that they're not, because I can't remember who it was, but his eyebrow was practically hanging off. You know what I mean? It was like, whoa, and they let it go. And I was like, see, that it's in certain states.
I'll use Klitschko versus Lennox Lewis as an example, right? There's a reason that happens. Like, the officials there are competent to do that job. The majority of officials that attend those events are the cream. The UFC are the cream. I mean, honestly, they don't hire bums. They just don't. There may be mistakes that are made here and there, and I'm not saying for a second that's one of them. But all I'm trying to say is, like, the dollar value of a fight can affect the goalposts, the moral goalposts, and whether a fight stops or continues. And I'll use Vitali Klitschko as an example of that. Or I'll use Olympic boxing as an example of it also. If you had somebody who was slightly older, I'll keep it simple. Vitali Klitschko versus Lennox Lewis, that was a multi-million dollar fight, right? So it really depends on the dollar value of the fight. And sometimes, the dollar value of the fight. It just depends on the dollar value of the fight. And I'm not using the UFC as an example. I'm not going to knock my colleagues. I'm not going to do that.
No. There was a catch-22 with that fight with Nate Diaz, because as a person that wants to take the officials course, you know, it's your job as fighter safety.
Yeah.
You know, that's your job. And so, you know, I do see from that perspective that, like, yeah, it was a bad cut. And, you know, was he going to do something spectacular? I mean, that to me would have been the only other call would say, you know, you better make something happen in the next couple of minutes or you're done. You know what I mean? But I've watched, who was it? The Raquel Pennington, when she fought Holly Holm.
Yeah.
They continued that fight when she told them, I don't want to continue fighting.
As a referee,
I would have stepped in and said the fight's done. As a referee, I would have said the fight's over. I'm overriding the coach. If that's her, you know, she mouthed those words, I would have called the fight.
See, what happened in that was, as far as I can see, I mean, I can't really comment because I seen that, but I don't think the referee actually heard what happened in the corner. But I do know.
I was like, why didn't they just stop it? You know what I mean? That was an unnecessary ending to a fight.
But the thing was, like, everything that we do on the UFC is scrutinized and analyzed. So basically, they run it back in Vegas. And then we'll be held accountable for our good work and our bad work. And so basically, nothing goes that's not scrutinized. And so basically, you know, like I said to you, they're constantly evolving, changing, and trying to make the sport a better place. They're constantly doing that. There's nothing like them. Globally, in terms of the what they invest into the sport and the athletes, male or female, there's nothing like them. And in safety standards also. The thing is, if I was to put it back to you, our sport is not black and white. It's just not black and white. The rules and regulations are in black and white, right? Mm-hmm. They're in black and white. They say if a fighter can defend himself and throw punches back, they can continue. And this is like globally in most combat sports. I'm not using any one specifically. But that doesn't naturally represent whether the fighter is capable or is taking the hiding of their life, taking the beating of their life, right? You could be throwing punches back and, you know, like, but you're not in passive guard. If you're in passive guard, it's all...
And are you landing them? Yeah. Are they effective? Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it.
But it's not black and white. And so Forbes done a study. And so Forbes studied this and they said basically, in terms of rules and decision making, right, if the interpretation of the rule is taken as it's written, okay, there is a definite fault because people are trying to use the rule as a source or a measure, but that as it's written. But the interpretation of that as it's happening can be a whole different thing.
Absolutely.
And so the gray area that we deal with is when we go out there to work with somebody, and I'll give you an example because I've worked in Olympic boxing. There's a 34-year-old male or female in the corner. It's the last time at the Olympics, right? The last time at the Olympics. And here they are now. They're two rounds up, and they come into the corner, and they have a nasty injury, but the referee hasn't picked up on it. And you're one of the corner people walking in the corner, right? And you see that injury, and it's severe and it's nasty. Now, your duty is to call the referee, who calls doctor, who then examines the injury to stop the fight. That's how it's supposed to happen. Well, you know that 34-year-old male or female sitting in the corner, and it shouldn't budge you in terms of your decision. It's their last time in the Olympics. This could mean a gold medal instead of a silver medal. If they make it to the end of, they've changed the rule. I know they've changed the rule. If it goes to the end of round two, it goes to the scorecard. So say if it was round between round one and two. And you know the fighter has a chance. You hang on in there because you want to give them the best chance possible. It's a hard decision to make, and only those in that position can really make it. And I'll always use the example of Eddie Futch, Joe Lewis versus Muhammad Ali, the Thriller in Manila, where Muhammad Ali wanted to get his gloves cut off, when Angelo Dundee goes back to the corner and he says to Angelo Dundee, cut the gloves off, I'm done here, I'm finished. Joe Frazier's in the corner, the other corner, and Eddie Futch says to him, you've been eating right hands for the last three rounds, why, what's happening? He says, I can't see. Now, Joe Frazier had a dodgy eye anyway, one dodgy eye, but it just so happened it was the good eye. So Eddie Futch said, right, okay, this is round 14 going into 15, and historically, people say he may have been ahead on the cards, Joe Lewis. And Joe Lewis hated Muhammad Ali at this point because he basically bankrolled him through the whole, when they tried to, when he refused to inscription to go into the Vietnam War, right? And then when he got his license back, Muhammad Ali got his license back, he slagged Joe Lewis off. Joe Lewis is like, what? I can't believe this is the same guy. I bankrolled him through the bad times and now he's, you know, giving me a hard time. So there's a lot of hatred there. So here he was against his nemesis and he had an opportunity to, you know, he wanted to continue. But Eddie Futch said, no, it's finished. It's over. He had 3 minutes left to fight. 3 minutes. Eddie Futch made that decision. It was the bravest decision I've ever seen a coach make because he may have went on the next 3 minutes and won the fight, or he may have gone on and suffered something that was just irreparable, traumatic brain injury or something like that. Nobody will ever know. But what I'm trying to say to you is it takes courage in a position like that when you know the dollar value of the fight, you know the consequences of stopping the fight. You know sometimes when you're walking with a kid that's stopping the fight, if they continue, you may be able to, off the basis of them winning that fight, that means they could launch them into $1 million pay bracket, which means that they could secure them and their families, you know, lives or whatever, you know what I mean, or whatever. So it's never black and white, and that shouldn't really impair your decision making. But guess what? We're made out of flesh and blood. Sometimes that swims through your head when you're in there.
Yeah.
And you're looking at the kid, and you're not medically qualified to make the call, and the kid's telling you, I want to fight, because they always want to fight anyway. But sometimes it's like the world flashes right there in front of your eyes. You're thinking of all of this. Last time in the Olympics, you got your cat back.
She's back. She's like, fell down.
But all I'm trying to say is not black and white. It's not black and white.
You must enjoy the interview.
Yeah.
And as well, that wasn't a criticism of the UFC team there with the doctor or anything. That was kudos to the cup man, who I just couldn't believe that cup was... They did stop it bleeding, in my opinion.
No, they did
an incredible job of it.
But look, I don't like criticizing my colleagues. Like, I'd rather use my own work as an example.
Yeah.
And I've had nights where I've missed the obvious. And people say, oh, that must have been years ago. No, it wasn't years ago. It was actually, it would have happened over the past couple of years. Although my mistakes would be smaller than they've been before, because I'm working professionally 25 to 45 shows a year.
Yeah.
I still make them. And so sometimes you're in a position, you're in a position where you see something happening and you know it's wrong. And when you walk away from it, you knew you made the wrong decision. And that haunts you. It absolutely just haunts you. Because again, like, you're putting a kid in a position where they may suffer something that's, you know, unnecessary. You know, even if it's just a beating they shouldn't have received, you're a response. You could have said something. Because I've walked in boxing corners and I've seen it. And then equally, I've walked in other corners where it's been blatant that the people in the corner hadn't the qualification to actually corner anybody, ever, ever. And they've let a kid take a complete beat, and you're standing there and you're going, why? What was that about like? But again, like, my shit stinks. It does stink. I've made those mistakes, and it's through making mistakes that you want to kind of make the sport a safer place, because, you know, the consequences are huge.
Yeah.
Are huge. You get it wrong. We all have a part to play, and we're all responsible. If you look at Dennis Munson's death in the ring, in you know, there were a group of qualified people with over 100 years experience who all made bad decisions, but they were influenced by other things. We make decisions based on experiences sometimes, and sometimes if somebody doesn't call it over there, well, you think it's okay because he didn't call it, so it must be okay. And then again, if you in that particular case, he was a debutant. People just thought he was knackered, tired. He was actually starting to suffer from traumatic brain injury. Yeah, faulty gait, stuff like that, and all the rest of it. And people ignored the obvious signs. Even a doctor that worked in A&E that was at the event. They had all the qualifications. But sometimes you're so desensitized by what you're seeing that it becomes the norm, and you just, somewhere you just brush it aside.
Yeah.
I've had the experience where I've heard the next day that the kid was dead. I've had the experience already. And Uncle Bob has had the experience four times. I've had the experience. It's sickening to think that you were a part of that, that you were there, that, you know, like, so I can't stress it enough. And that's the reason I don't really have time for all that egomaniac bollocks. And it doesn't belong. We're only officials. There's nothing that irritates me more than to see officials go, number one, you know, covered in blood spatter, number one. What the fuck is that all about? Seriously, is it a competition? And in which case, where's the starting line? Because I didn't know this based on. You know, if you were starting a competition, you could have told me. What's the criteria? You know, can we all play?
Yeah.
I'll always be at the end because I've got no energy for all of that crap.
That's the way out of that.
Do you know what, though, is I think of the hard time I give myself when I've done a bad interview and I've said something really stupid and I'm like, that's up online and I've made a twat of myself. And the only way I make myself feel better about it is nobody got hurt, nobody's going to die. You know, you look like a twat on the internet, but, you know,
That's you'll live to report another
you guys are taking those consequences that you guys are living with. Like, you know, you're helping people, and even if you help 999 out of 1,000, you've also got to live with 1,000 that would have happened with anybody who was looking after them that night, but you've still got to live with the consequences.
Yeah. That stuff haunts me, because I take it personal. And people say, you know, let it go. Yeah, I do to some degree, but I take it personal. Because if I carry the weight of every participant that's I've ever educated, and I know they look at me. And the thing is, you know, I'd love to say that I'm a shining example every time I go out there. But because our game is so unpredictable in terms of what can happen in a corner, you can't control it. The environment is unstable, constantly changing all the time in a corner. Could be a crazy coach, could be this, could be that. Fighters just up and down, it's mad. You could have people coming in from outside, shaking the cage or jumping over the ring or in the ring or at the ring. You could be distracted by whatever's happening, you know what I mean? It's just, it's an unstable environment and it's constantly changing. And what you're trying to do is actually bring some calm to the storm. And that's why I'm saying, like, that guy, I hope he makes some bucks, the guy that worked on, say, from Tyson Fury's cut.
Tyson Fury.
Yeah, honestly. And I hope he learns from it. And the thing is, again, I'd share that I've made mistakes in the profession also. And I don't like using other, there were parts of it that I wouldn't have enjoyed watching as a professional. But you know what? He has the ability, like every human being, to actually, you know, improve and get better at it. And so I think anybody that wants or loves what they do, they always want to be better at it. And the only way we can be better at it is if we open and we take criticism, and I mean off the right people, off your peers. And he may not regard me as a peer, but that's all right. Doesn't matter. I'm just another cut man. From being straight, you ask me a question, I'm being straight.
Yeah.
And I've done that.
There must be something that keeps you doing this, though, Joe, when, you know, you could do lots of other things with your life and you're still in there helping people, treating people. What is it that keeps you doing this job?
If I'm being honest with you, I'm in transition. I've been doing it for 15 years now. And so I'm putting her up online on film because I want to spend more time at home. I have to get up in the morning and go get visas and stuff like that, and you know, it's travel is great, it's fantastic, and it's enlightening, and it's the best educator of all things. But I'm in my 50s now, and I'm at a period of time in my life where I've never stopped loving it. It's the heartbeat for me, it's my passion, but I want to spend a little bit more time around the nest and stuff. You know, and if I can bank that up online and I can make it interactive and, you know, again, like, to answer your question directly, there's only one reason I started it in the first place, was just to try improve the standards of corner care. Now, there's cook courses springing up all over the place now. And all I'll say is that I hope whoever's doing a cook course.
I only recommend one. You're the only one I recommend, so let's not bother about all the others.
No, well, I think it's good if we are educating people on hygiene, sanitation, concussion, all that stuff. I think it's fantastic, but you seriously need to do with the right, with keeping the fighter in at the heart of it, rather. Yeah. We need to lose that bullshit for another round. Keep the fighter in the. We need to, that needs to be assessed as it happens in the moment when it's happening. You know what I mean? And the only way you can do that is if you're in the moment rather than just thinking. If you're not practiced in the game, what happens is you need, I'm going to wipe it first, then I'm going to stick my treatment in, and then I'm going to hold it there for 10, 9, or 40 seconds, and then I'm going to put my grease in. When you're a practiced professional, it happens subconsciously without even thinking of it. If they move their head, you're gone with them because you've done it so many times. And you move your angle to let the coach in and do his thing and all the rest, or her thing, whatever it is. It's because you're practiced. And you don't have to think about it subconsciously anymore. It's just in your, it's ingrained in you. You've been there, you've made those mistakes, you've been doing it for 15 years. But when you get complete rookies in there, they're just thinking of the basics all the time. And that's where we need to stand over that. We need to supervise that and make sure that the people that are getting in there are capable and competent of actually delivering that service to the athlete, rather than taking a risk and exposing the athlete to someone that doesn't actually know what they're doing. And I think that's the loophole in the whole game. Even the online course, what I tried to do was set up platforms that people can connect with us, like a Q&A. Now, I do that in many platforms. In Germany, I have one running at the moment, and I have a world one that you're a member of, Becky. And, you know, I post things up, but I could count on my hands the amount of time people have actually responded to the stuff that I post. Like of my own work or of you know, situations or talking points in mixed martial arts where officials have been involved and say, what would have you done? Yeah. So tell us a lot about human nature.
Tell us where people can find those online things then, Joe.
I don't. I only open it up to groups that I've actually worked with.
Done the course.
Yeah, because they know where I'm coming from. However, I am open to anybody sending me an email. I'll always respond. Always respond. It may take me 3 or 4 days to do it, but I'll always respond. And I'll try to go through your email piece by piece. But the only way that I can have a look at your work, honestly, if you live across the globe, and Kerry will relate to this, telephone, telegraph,
yes.
And I won't finish the last one. You know what I'm talking about.
I definitely do.
We're in the same club. But what was he going to say? I don't know. That's people's personal choice. You know what I mean? Sometimes people are just happy to do the course, walk away, and never do any continued professional development. But what's happened is we have two new generations now, centennials and millennials. The second biggest group we have coming to the Cutman course now are centennials. They're from 18 to 24 years of age. The biggest group we have is between 25 and 34. They're the biggest group we have at us at the moment. We're younger than referees. We're far younger than referees. So there's younger people coming in. They have a whole different philosophy. They want to do something that's meaningful and worthwhile and stuff. You know, like, and they ask a whole different set of questions. And it's really good for me because it makes you feel kind of awkward. You know, I never thought of that, actually.
Yeah.
You know, like, when people say to me, you know, how do you know the difference between that and that? And sometimes it's just purely instinct. But I'll always say to them, your reference is the doctor. The referee, you call the referee makes the decision, or, you know, and then he'll call the doctor if he needs to. Just go back and just go fundamentals, keep it in, thing and all the rest of it, you know what I mean? So.
Yeah. Well, girls, we've run well over time as usual, so I'm going to come to you, girls, because you know that we haven't touched on half the topics that we were going to bring up today.
Yeah,
so we had
so much stuff.
You did?
But I just wondered if there was anything you girls wanted to ask Joe on this podcast before we ask him to come back on another one and finish all the other stuff.
Definitely, we're going to have to.
Yeah. If you can deal with all the hate mail.
We don't mind hate mail. I'll take care of that.
We don't have that.
You've told everyone you'll reply to every email now, so I hope you don't have many thousands of people who are going to watch this podcast.
It's very niche. You know, globally, there's something like 60 inquiries a month for this. Globally. It's niche. It's very niche.
God, and the thing is, special when you replied to me.
Yeah, but you are. There you go. You are. But the thing is, you carry the message forward. You know, like, the thing is, they may stop the messenger in some regards. Like, I have tried to run courses in certain places and they told me to sod off. And I have connected with organizations and they've told me to sod off. And the thing is, they may stop the messenger, but they'll never stop the message.
Nope. Yeah,
sure. Ever. Simple as, they'll never stop the message. And if you really mean what Fighter fighter safety means, if you really take that on board, if you really take that on board and you embrace, you actually know what it means because you've seen the consequences of not enacting it.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, that's all I'm saying.
Great.
Been a pleasure. How come it's still sunny there, Kerry? Are you in the UK, Kerry?
No, I'm over in New York.
You kidding me?
No, I'm serious. It's still light out. Not I know that. It's all our parents around to be with us this afternoon.
Yeah.
We really appreciate that. Thank you, Kerry. We got some snow yesterday. So, it's
what
all
time
right
is
here.
It?
It's right now it's 4:20. Oddly enough.
Middle of the day. No wonder your cat's going crazy.
Yeah, they go crazy all the time. It doesn't even matter what time it is. They're just, they're the craziest cats I've ever had in my life, but I love them.
Yeah, animals are great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah. Sorry, I missed that part. You all spoke at the same time.
We do that. Sorry, Becky, is there anything you wanted to end with?
Oh,
me? Yeah.
Oh, well, I suggest that we get Joe on again next year to ask him more. We had so many things we wanted to ask him individually that I think that makes for another show. So if Joe doesn't mind coming back again next year, we can... We can ask him more questions and then we can bug him even more then.
If anyone wants to comment on this podcast, any questions they've got for the next one, then I'll happily save them all. And Joe, if you don't mind, it's been fantastic having you on. So
yeah, thank you, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Joe.
And likewise, thanks for having me, girls. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay. Thank you. Bye. Good one in the books, girls.
Yay!
Well,